We're focusing on Ma'amar Lamed Beis in the Sichas Musar, and tonight the idea is like this. Let's start at the very beginning. He actually focuses on two aspects, and we're going to focus on one of those. One is a notion which appears in Parshas Hashiva Eira, which is about the Mako of Shechin. We're really stuck in the middle of the Makos right now, so we're between 7 and 3, and so there's a lot of interesting things to think about, like, you know, why the pattern 7-3, why did the Torah see, or the Parashios see fit to be split up in such a way, you know, the cycle of the finishing the Torah in a year, that actually Knesset Gdol at that time was setting up. Why was it such that we have a 7-3? We have other 7-3 patterns in Torah systems, but nonetheless, so towards the end of Parashas Va'era, we hear about the plague of Shechin. And here's we're going to start from the second paragraph in this of the section. It's, the title is called Yichad Lev. Yichad literally means like unity of heart. So what is he talking about here? So he says an interesting thing. He has his argument. Vehine, he says, hey Donny, vir birois paroi es makas shchin kosu vaychazek Hashem es lev paro. So he sees the makro of shchin, and it says that Paro's heart was strengthened, which means, meaning Hashem strengthened his heart. Let's just be clear for a second over here. How many makos, what number maka is Shechin?
7.
Maka is actually? 6.
6.
Okay, because borrowed is 7, arba 8, choshech 9, makos b'chor is 10, right? So number 6 is Shechin. At that point in time, it's the first time that we see Hashem intervening in the heart of Paro. It's interesting. Even though Hashem says beforehand, I'm going to be mechazek the lev Paro, the first time you actually see it in action is in Makas Shechin. Fascinating. Why so? But why is this? Kolomar, this means to say, ilulei chizek Hashem es liboy, kvar hayo meshaleach es Yisrael. The implications, as the Ramban and the Sforno point out, is if Hashem had not sort of fiddled with his heart, he would have just, you know, bow down, and you know he would have relented and sent out Bnei Israel, right? Rashi famously says, by the way, just to appreciate this point, Rashi famously says that if you notice, it's critical. The first 5 is when he was mechazek his own heart. The last 5, it says Hashem was strengthened or hardened his heart, which means to say, he started the process of being obstinate, and Hashem finished the process of being obstinate. Fascinating, if you look in the parentheses here, he says, Ayin Sforno Sham V'Ramban. So they both say are two interesting, very very interesting facts. One why is this the critical moment in the plagues, in the trajectory of all the 10 plagues, that Paro needed to have this extra chizuk lev from HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So the Sforno says something very simple. What's unique about Shechin that we haven't seen up till now?
Sorcerers couldn't repeat it.
What was that? So sorcerers couldn't repeat already from 4 onwards, apparently. Right? So that happened earlier. So that you're right, that theologically. But there's even more symbols done. It's the first one which really actually hit the body itself. Do you know what I'm saying? The rest of them were environmental. Right? Environment can be terrible, and sometimes you can't escape environment, but if it's on your body, it's getting really close to home. So the Sforno says is that physical torture is a force to be reckoned with. It's very, very hard to deal with that. So that's what the Sforno says, that he needed the extra chizuk. At the same time, also the Ramban, he's quoting in the parentheses, is also important to see. The Ramban says an interesting thing, is, you know, just to understand this, you know, Hashem fiddling with our free will, like, you know, how is Hashem, interrupting Paro's free will over here? So the answer the Ramban gives is such a brilliant, brilliant answer, such an incredible insight into human nature. If you were to ask Pharaoh at this point in time, Pharaoh, do you want to send out the Jews or not? His answer would be unequivocally,
no.
No. But you can torture him to the point that he'll say, I'll do it. But if you were to take him out of the torture chamber and say, would you like to send the Jews? His answer would be still no. But what buckled him was the torture. You know, I read a book called The Dogs of God, which is about the Dominican friars and the Spanish Inquisition. Very, very interesting book. They were used to call themselves the hounds or the dogs of God. They sort of felt that they were doing God's willing bidding by eliminating those who are heretical to Catholicism. And and you know, when you read about the stories of, you know, the Inquisition, what they did, like, you know, they would, you know, a person who had an accusation thrown against them was considered guilty until proven innocent. So you had many people, you know, many domestic disputes where the person would just say, you know, they're actually a closet Jew. They'd be taken in, and they'd basically, you know, be tortured to the point. And usually the people who would be taken in are people who had assets, because it was obviously economically driven. There was a war being going on in the south against the Moors, and the crown needed lots of money for that. And so the Inquisition was a very viable way of getting lots of money, because they confiscated assets in many other cases, even when they didn't kill people. So there was a, they took an average story of this, you know, this lady who'd converted her when she was a child to Christianity, and she was accused of being still practicing Jewish beliefs, and she protested, they tortured her terribly, and then she'd admit under torture, and then she'd come out in front of the tribunal, and she would say, I deny everything I said inside there, because that's not what I meant, and they'd torture her again, and she'd denied, to the point that they tortured her so much that she was such a broken woman that, of course, she had confessed in the tribunal just for the sake of not getting back into the torture chamber, and then they confiscated her assets. And that when she made the confession, they had to teach her what to say that she believed in, because she didn't really know. It was terrible, terrible things. But the point is that, as the Ramban says over here, is Paro was in the torture chamber. And so he would buckle just because a human being would buckle under such pressure. So the chizuk lay that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was giving is allowing him the fortitude to be able to live with his corrupt assumptions of life. That's a brilliant, brilliant insight.
So it says Vayechazek, it doesn't say Vayechabed.
Yes, well, there's two different expressions.
Right, so it goes well with the Ramban. He strengthened him to do what he really wanted.
Nachon. It was his natural, exactly. But anyway, so that's all in the parentheses, as what he's referring to. Now comes Rav Chaim Shulevitz's question. Now that we got the basics on the table, so he says, the one of Yesh Li Zbonein, Ma Ra'o Paro B'Makas Shchin Yoser Mikol Makos Shekod Mulo Ma Hoya B'Makos Zu Kedei L'Hachni O Yeser Al Shara Makos. So he says, why is it that this mako was more humiliating, was more devastating than any other previous mako? So he says, check out the sword, and says, because of the physical pain, but he says there's something else in it. He's going to get into a psychological suggestion. So what it is like this. I underline the actual sources of the Midrashim and the Pesukim that he's quoting, and then perhaps we'll analyze it ourselves. So here's how he says. He quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which says, Adam HaRishon, Misoif HaOlam, Va'ad Soif HaHaya. Adam HaRishon, before the Chait, was from one end of the world to the other end of the world. Adam Rishon mina Oretz Ad LaRakia Haya, and he was as tall as from earth to heavens. V'kevan Shesarach, when he sinned, Hinyach Gadosh Baruch Hu Yadoi Olav Umiatoi. And Akash Baruch Hu, so to speak, put his hand on him and diminished him. So you can imagine sort of this expansive scope of this human, sort of in all directions, upwards and sideways. And like, what does that really mean? Like, what does it mean? You know, like, we've all heard this Midrash, you know, but it's, you know, how are you supposed to interpret that, you know, like that's clearly hyperbolic or clearly metaphoric, right? Because it doesn't make sense. So he has his suggestion. He says, "Venirash ena kavona v'kipshuta." That obviously does not mean literally like that. Shirochov v'gavoy yoyomot misoyfo elam atsoyfo mina aretz ad larakia ela hakavonohi. What's the point? Lekoychoy sov v'hasagosay to his potential abilities and to his perception. His capabilities, his potential were heaven high and without bound or horizon. That's what he's saying. Hakol haya bichlal heseg yodai. Everything was within his potential ability to achieve. V'lo haya mugbal machmas richuk mokom. Ad shesorach vivu lakosh baruch hos kochom yaton. Then Hashem sort of pulled back his potential into sort of a more diminished realm. Okay, that's the way he understands it. So, still, it's a little okay. Still sounds a little hyperbolic. So, what does he really mean here? His way of explaining this is so brilliant. He takes the famous midrash which appears 2 weeks ago, which talks about the Bas Paro, the daughter of Pharaoh, and the just skipping to the underline in the paragraph, it says Vatishlochis Amoso Vatikochel. She sees this baby. She says she sends her amo and she gets it. She nishtarbevo yodoi gishal basio Bas Paro. Amois Harbe. Famously, the Gemara in Sota, Yud Beis and Beis, Rashi quotes in the Chumash, which is why all, you know, kindergarten children come back telling it to us, is that really, what does it mean to Shlach's Amosah? Amosah could mean her maidservant, but it could mean her arm, which extended to many Amos. What does that mean? Da'ena kavana. That doesn't mean shnis al shnis arucha yoda mamish. You know that suddenly she, you know, genetically speaking, you know that suddenly her bone grew at an astronomical rate. Va'akach shuv naase neis v'chozer yoda lekamoshoy. And there was a second miracle that she didn't have to walk around with the extended arm for the rest of her life. Ela shal yedekach she azra basya bas paro es kol kolchois nafsho latzil es ayeled. Because she invested all of her energies into saving the child, therefore it was enabled her in potential, that same, so we'll call it, pre-Homo sapien state of before the sin, she was able to do something which didn't seem humanly possible. Not because her arm naturally extended, but this would not be within her normal capabilities to reach that far, to get that far by herself, and she was able to do it. So if we take the sports camera here, you know, shut the slide by slide, you know, like, you know, frame by frame, what was actually going on, what I would imagine he's saying is that she was able to exert her energy to get there and back without drowning, even though she didn't know how to swim, or she got there in a way which, you know, if you were to ask on an average day, she would have been swept away by the currents, you know, and she wouldn't have been able to do this. So why? How could she do this? She was able to send her arm. Why? Because all the energies were focused on this particular goal. Fascinating, right? You know, there's where you see some of the things, just as an interesting addendum over here, is in Sefer Yehoshua, it talks about how Yeshua in Perek Yud turns to the sun and says, "Shemesh be given dom." That the sun, reach ba'emek ayalon, right? So that the moon and sun stand still. The moon and sun standing still is not exactly a simple operation. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's not like, you know, there's a switch behind the mountains. You know where? That's everything. You know, gravity doesn't just, you know, one day doesn't exist, right? Everything would be ruined and killed. So the Mepharshim say, no, that's what happened. HaKadosh Baruch Hu instilled, there were two particular junctures in time when time stopped. And this was completely supernatural. But the Ralbag doesn't go in for that type of interpretation. The Ralbag says on a very rational basis, no. What happened? It says that the sun stopped, and they chased the enemies into the whole day, and they were able to capture them and to destroy this coalition that they were fighting against. It was a coalition of five kings, Canaanite kings. So says, okay. He says, no. When was Hashem girded them with enough strength that they could catch all their enemies in a remarkably fast way before the end of the day, that it felt like time was in fact stopping. Right? So what he's saying is that not necessarily like, you know, the miracle's happening. The miracle is that they could supernaturally achieve everything they needed to within the constraints of that experience. So that seems to be a little bit what he's saying over here, which is fascinating. So what's the power really over here? Is the power is human? What's the word we'd use for this? Not potential, but the human drive, right? When you have a drive for something, you can possibly achieve. That's his suggestion.
Since scientifically, a lot of times, chas v'shalom, somebody's in a car accident, the rush of the epinephrine, the adrenaline in one place, can cause a person to mamas lift up the car and...
Yes, so he actually mentions that. He mentioned that in two paragraphs, this idea where under gross trauma, human beings do things which they could never have imagined doing on a calm and regular Monday. Exactly that point. So going back just to the previous thought then, so what he says is that Adam HaRishon, that Misayfo Olam Ad Soifoi, would mean that, it doesn't mean to say that Adam HaRishon was, you know, very large. It meant that his capabilities and potential were so vast that wherever he set his sights to, he could understand, reach, do. Right? It's a description of potential. Then he gives another example. This is famous example. The next paragraph, he says, "V'chemasim Yaakov avinu alav shalom v'yagal sa'even me'al pi aver." So Yaakov rolls off the stone. He says, and Rashi says, "Kamo shemavir sapakak me'al atzlochis," that like he removes the cork from the bottle or the plate, and I made sure your kocha got it. Now, by the way, not everybody's good at getting the cork out, but in those days, we're not talking about the same type of we talk about the jugs, right? Thicker. So we're talking about the wine bottles of today. But the Rashi's trying to say it was with ease. What does that mean? He says gam kan ena kavanah bekipshuta lakoyach gufani. It's not referring to, you know, physical strength and how can you bench press 250 on a regular day. Ala kafisha amar abala payet b'tfilas geshem. We just said this on Shmini Atzeres. Yichad leiv v'gal even mipi be'er mayim. Bavurai altim namaim. So one of those, you know, those verses in that stanza is the one who is yichad leiv, who focused his heart and rolled the stone from above the well of water, which referring to Yaakov. Bavurai in his merit altim namaim. Don't hold back water from us. So he helped the shepherds get the water. Help us get the water that we need. Geshem translated into, you know, the economy, the crops, the inflation, all the things that immediately affect us. Right. So that's what we're saying. Hashem, please don't hold that back from us. Yaakov was a staunch fellow. You know, he could, you know, just pick up anybody. That's not the reason why we ask that for rain. Because his focus of energy. He could do something which was beyond the regular capabilities of human beings. And that's why we say HaKadosh Baruch Hu, like he was able to focus all his energies on what he believed was important right now. Please, in that schus that we could do such a thing, please allow us to have the water the necessary.
But it was still a physical strength that he...
You're right. So you asked the same question.
Yeah.
Right. You're asking the same question. I still struggle with this. Meaning to say, he's still got the rock off, right? But there's this burst of strength because of something he believed in deeply, which allowed him to do something under normal circumstances would not have been possible. So he comes into Tali's example, which is like this, the right here, which is he now talks about how Yaakov didn't sleep for 14 years. He says he believed, you know, the Medrash says there's a missing 14 years in his life, and famously the Medrash says that he went to the Yeshiva Shem Ve'ever, spent 14 years there, and he says that it comes from the same capability in the human spirit. Now, he says, take a look at the bottom of the last paragraph on this page. With four lines up, there's a period. He says, we see that in different individuals. Like you said, Tali. When a person, you know, we hear stories of people are trapped in fiery infernos, Rachman Litzan. You know, people lifted huge beams and rafters from atop of other people to that they, under no normal circumstance, would they be able to do. Pressured circumstances force a person to do things which he would never be able to do. Harbeila mala mikoicho haragil, more than his regular strength. So did he, you know? So coming back, so it sounds like from the way he's saying it here, is that, you know, Yaakov regular would not have been able to, but with his focus, he gave an extra burst of strength, which is in this thing. The Bnei Yisrael regular would not have been able to conquer the enemy so fast, because of their, you know, their deep emunah, their deep belief, their deep desire to do this. They were gifted extra energy, which felt like time was stopping. You know,
very similar to in karate, and they have those beams.
Right,
focus. The point, focus, and the concentration level to hit it right at that spot where it'll split all the
yoga and all that stuff.
it's interesting. You know, so he doesn't use the word chi. which is what the focus is over there. It's not so much even just a focus on a spot, it's actually just focusing all the energy in a human being into one point. And I mean, there are people who can do this just by touching. You know, there's people I've met who've done this before. There's no question. That's very interesting. But I guess that shows us what's in the capacity of a human being. You know, there's a fellow, there's a Dr. Sova at YU. It's a dojo.
Harvey Sober.
Yeah.
So you know what I'm saying?
So he's a very interesting individual. Yeah. He can do some pretty intense stuff. Mm-hmm. You know. So he still teaches at YU. He is able to with mere touch split rocks in half. You know, with his force, the capability of a human being. Now that's one way of channeling it. And many people see this.
Is it analogous to like the Gedolim or the Mekubals who could sort of see because of their ability to concentrate or their commitment?
For those are real. There's no question, and there certainly are real people out there who do this. And it sounds like the human capacity. And potential is far greater than we are utilizing. You know, you always hear these studies about, you know, how much do we utilize 10% of our brain capacity and things like that. What that means, you know, what the, you know, it's hard to know, but there's no question that certain people have more extensive abilities, whether it be in perception, whether it be in physical aptitude. You know, it's interesting to see this. So this is his argument. Now, he says, Al Yomar Adam, I'm told the next page. So the problem is that this actually comes with a responsibility, as he usually says it. So it isn't just a freebie. It's not just an easy license. He says, this means so that nobody should ever say, you know, I can never, right? My strengths are limited. I know my limitations, right? That's a mistake. Everything depends on his what his will is and his focus. If a person realizes how much they really desperately want to learn Torah and really be involved in Torah, they will find within them the wellsprings of capability. And they will have inordinate strength in Torah, which is vastly wide and deep. If a person says, I have invested and I have found, do believe them. And that's why it's considered you earned it. Now, by the way, just to point out over here, I think, you know, it's interesting. There's a book written by Miriam Adahan called Awareness. Anyone's interested, it's about a certain psychological framework called the Enneagram. If anybody's it's one of these, you know, like the Myers-Briggs system, and there's all whole character awareness system. One of the things she argues in the beginning of the book is, this is a debate that we have in ourselves so many numerous times during in our lives is. And she says, like, you know, imagine that you had a schoolyard where you have different animals, and they're all there, and you know, you have a duck, and you have a dog, and a donkey, and a bird, and a tortoise, and they all have to compete in the same competition. So, you know, when it comes to getting across water, the duck's obviously going to win, and when it comes to survival, the tortoise is probably going to win. When it comes to speed, you know, everyone has different aptitudes. So obviously, you can't put all the same kind of people in the same class. And so her analogy is that self-awareness is important to know that you have limitations, because if you don't have limitations, you say, I don't need glasses. I believe I can see. Well, they're going to say, sir, can you please put your hands on the dashboard? And then they'll escort you out of your car the next time that happens, right? So you can tell the world that you can see. But you know, but at the same time, you're a hazard to people. So there's certain things we agree the limitations with. So the argument that's used is in psychologically as well. We also have limitations. We need to recognize there are different character types, right? So you need to look in yourself and see what your parameters are, and be able to do that. The problem is that in that type of system, that type of looking, which is very much in the prescriptive way that society looks at we try to sort of pigeonhole, we try to give frames of reference for everything, then we end up limiting ourselves as well. What Racham Shlomish is arguing is that it's almost, in the way he's saying it, it's almost unbounded, meaning the human potential. And I'm sure we've all met people who, you know, who thought very little of themselves, or people thought very little of them, and look what they did with their lives, you know. And why? Because either they had somebody who loved them into existence, who loved them so much or saw potential, they themselves had enough confidence in themselves to break the bounds of their family, their economic their character, their place in life, and they did tremendous things. It's a balance. It's not so pashut. It's not so simple. I think that we need a little more of this. Then that we need self-awareness. There's no question we need to be aware of our parameters. But I think that we've got so good of recognizing parameters that we have now prescribed ourselves into nothingness. We don't understand what it means to aspire anymore. So it's a struggle, and I struggle with this all the time. But this is something which he's bringing up over here. He says finally, So we know that the Kohanim take their the feathers of the birds. Upa'amim sha'akoyen zorkon yos mishleishim amah. There would be reported cases of that throat for 30 amos, you know, more than, you know, 15 feet. Which is like meaning, it's not, you know, if you have something which is weighty, you can throw it, you know, but like you can try throwing a few feathers, try throwing a sheet of paper, right? It doesn't go too far, right? Mm-hmm. So he says they could throw it 15 feet. Hakohanim has reason babodosam, abodos hakodesh, ein lecha miyachte lev kamois. And their focus had to be extreme. If they had the wrong thoughts and they bring a korban, it would invalidate the korban. So he gives an example in the realm of the avodah itself, where you'd see that they would sort of exert this really, you know, incredible strength, which would be expressed in their service.
Those feathers must be very aerodynamic,
right? Or the power behind them, right? Just very, very interesting example. And now he goes on to Shechin. This is what happened with Moshe. So here it goes. The pasuk says, "Kachulachem maloich of nechem piach kushon." V'zarku Moshe Hashemayim leinei paro. So what happens is that he told them to take a handful of ash and throw it towards the heavens in front of Pharaoh. Pirush Rashi: V'zarku Moshe kol davar hanizrak b'koach eino nizrak ela biyad echad. So you can't really chuck things with two hands, right? When you're playing with basketball, there's one hand guarding, there's one hand throwing, right? You don't throw the baseball with two hands. You throw with one hand if you're going to really throw hard, right? By the way, it's one difference between rugby and American football, right? Just rugby, you always throw with two hands. There's more direction in football. It's one hand. Okay, anyway, it's just for those who have to convert over here. But nonetheless, so he says, if you want to really throw something hard, you need to throw it with one hand. Harei nisim harbe. There were many miracles. He says, number one is that he took Aaron and Moshe both took sort of a double portion, so they had two hands worth, and all those essentially four hands worth went into Moshe's hand. And number two is, and all of that dust went over and sort of carried over all of Mitzrayim, and that sort of precipitated the Makor Shechin. The Chassid Chachamim, who is a Pirush on Rashi, says, and they ask the following question: So look, if you're going to achieve a miracle, then just hold it there, right? Just you know, get it up there. You know, just kick it with the back of your foot, if for all intents and purposes. Why does it need to be that it was a miracle he threw it with all his strength and reached all of Mitzrayim? V'tirets, he says the Sifsei Chachayim, she'ein ha'nes b'meh sh'holach ha'avak al'pnei kol Mitzrayim elosh v'bozeh she'komets echad shum at avak hoyo bo'edai l'hispah el hafshit al kol eretz l'hispashet al kol eretz Mitzrayim. The miracle, he explains, wasn't that the avak went over all of Mitzrayim, but rather there was enough in the comets to divide itself over the all of Mitzrayim, which means, if you think about this, so really, 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 in what Moshe Rabbeinu did, his throw was strong enough that it could really reach that high and disperse. Physically, there wasn't enough of it to disperse. The miracle was only that it dispersed sufficiently to cover all of the Egyptian skies. But that it got there wasn't. Which means to say, what was Moshe doing over here? Here was another example he was saying is, Moshe Rabbeinu was so in the zone of this moment, that when he threw it, it really could have gone there. And if it had been under normal circumstances, it would have gone up, but it would have covered a small periphery perimeter, and it would radius, and it wouldn't have really gone much further than that. The miracle was that it spread all the way. But really, he did throw it all up to the sky. So he says, when Paro saw that, his argument is coming back to question one, which he presented is, what may Paro need chizuk lev now? It wasn't necessarily just the physical punishing that he was receiving. It was the fact that he saw Moshe Rabbeinu exerting himself in such a powerful way. He said, whoa, there's something going on over here, right? There's something going on, not just in terms of the outcome, but in terms of actually the vehicle. Moshe Rabbeinu, there's something terrifying about what Moshe Rabbeinu just did. And that was what he saw. Very interesting. So he witnessed that. When you see somebody like this, I know that when we did a Narcan training in the community, we should never have to know about it. But they say when Narcan is reverses the effects of particular overdoses, and what they say is that when a person immediately comes out of it, they're in a tremendous state of anger and pain from the sort of the immediate the immediate being taken out of that semi-conscious numb state into reality, and it's an extremely painful thing. And the recommendation always is to just immediately back off after administering a Narcan, because the person can get so angry, he can throw people. The person who is on that point, even though you just saved their life, but they can be so powerful. It's terrifying to see a person when they break through.
It's a conscious action,
right?
It's almost
like you just pull them through the fire. It's so painful, and they can do almost superhuman strength at that point in time. So it is always recommended to back off completely. Paro witnessed this kind of, you know, in the good sense. He witnessed a Moshe Rabbeinu with this incredibly powerful thing, and he says, "Whoa, wait a second." Then Hashem says, "Oh, Paro, here's what to say." And Paro had the chizuk lev at that moment in time when he saw that. Now again, a lot of this is midrashic, right? There's a lot of pieces over here. There's a lot of pieces we're missing if we just read the text itself. The argument which he tries to follow through over here is that under certain circumstances, in particular episodes where a person is incredibly focused, a person can achieve things which under normal circumstances would not be possible. It seems to be that he says that in the human capacity was, at the time before the sin of Chai Echelon Rishon, was almost boundaryless capacity. After the Chet HaKadosh Baruch Hu reined it back in, which is why we are limited creatures. We are limited human beings, ultimately. But our avoida, the responsibility that he's putting on our shoulders is not to keep limiting ourselves. I am such a person, therefore I do such a things. And it's interesting, if you listen, I find with the personally, if you listen to children, that's where you hear the right language. Children believe they can do everything. And then what happens is they finish school and they start going to, you know, yeshiva and university, and then they start realizing how much they can't do. And the further you go in life, the more you realize you can't do. And at a certain point, people sort of resolve themselves to their little cage, and they say, you know, this is what I can do, and I can't change the world, I can't do anything else. And I think there's trying to hear that child's voice still, that there's moments that we really can do if we're to choose to do it. That's what I take from this.
All these things are very physical.
They are very physical. Not necessarily with the perception of Adam Rishon. The idea, what he told is Mabit Misofa Adam Atsofa, that he said that there was a certain inner perception. So coming back to Eli's point beforehand, which is there are some people who also have this deeper sense of inner perception as well. Interesting, though. Very, very, very interesting perspective.
And he still sinned. Adam Rishon.
Correct.
Maybe because
you have to go into the sin of Adam Rishon. Adam Rishon was obviously, you know, making a very specific and precise decision, and he felt that despite what he was doing, it was a better way to serve Hashem. And you know, hopefully we'll have a chance to really go through the nitty gritty over there. But generally speaking, when you're told by Hashem that I want you to serve me in Derech A, and you choose Derech B, even though you think Derech B is better than Derech A, it doesn't usually work out. But then people done that all the way through history. You know, there's all kinds of ways. Shaul HaMelech. You know, I'm gonna save the sheep and I'll serve you the way Hashem said, and I told you to slaughter it.
Right.
So. Right. Exactly. There's new, and that's why, by the way, Chet Egel Azov is a reframing of the same of Chet Rishon, Pascha Zuamosam at Har Sinai, and going back into that same moment is that when we think we can serve Hashem in a better way than the way He told us to serve Him, but there's a consideration there, and that, this is one of the ramifications of it. Anyways. Food for thought. Thank you so much for making your time.